Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Employment numbers hit the skids. We had the Bernanke bounce, or was it a dead cat bounce? And we see movement from both sides of the bull and the bear camp saying why we should invest and why we should get out. This is Andrew Horowitz. It's episode number 228 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. How are you? We're going to start right up with a discussion. This is my favorite time of the year, the end of the summer. I used to remember going to school after Labor Day. It was always after the Jerry Lewis telethon. We'd go back to school down here in Florida. Not the same. Down here in Florida, you go to school like in August. But I thought we'd bring another Floridian. He is a researcher, an investor, a longtime student of the markets, Frank Curzio, one of the favorite guests that we have, if not the favorite guest that we have, and a friend of mine. So, Frank, how are you?
I'm doing good, but a Floridian, I don't know, you're killing me, pal. I'm still from New York. I just live in Florida.
Oh, yeah. Well, right. Just a transplant, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So, it's the, you know, I thought... Sometimes, or oftentimes, it seems to me that the school year, at least up in the north, is coordinated with the actual market cycle in a way that, you know, everybody kind of looks at coming back after Labor Day refreshed and looking to trade. Sometimes they take off through the summer, et cetera. You see the light volumes. You know, the selling may go away. We're kind of back to September, you know, what you're going to remember. And what do you think kind of, we're going to see? Is there going to be... an increase in volume immediately? What is usually the trend right about now, you know, when we come back?
You know, it's difficult to measure trends right now because, history says that September is one of the worst months to invest. A lot of our crashes happen in October. But, you know, usually markets do decent in August, and we saw a huge decline where it was 2.5 weeks where the Russell 2000 lost 25%. So, you know, you can take those figures for what they're worth, according to if you're going to invest, what the trading Bible says. But you know what, going forward, I think you're going to see a little bit of volume pick up next month and also in October, but I wouldn't be so quick to hit the sell button and say, you know, I think September's a bad month, so I'm just going to get out, especially after what we just have in August.
Well, I think also I'll tell you this, that once you start seeing all the headlines about September being the worst month ever, and you know, in the buy and sell in May and go away and Head and Shoulders, when that starts to become a headline on CNBC, you need to scratch your head and say, now that the cat is out of the bag and everybody knows this, it probably is not going to happen. Now, I don't mean that in a literal sense, but, you know, it's usually the most often less recognized patterns are the ones that play out.
No, I definitely agree. I mean, if you're looking... You know, you're looking at September again. When you're looking at statistics or you're looking at headlines, the thing you should do is look at what already happened. For example, when you're looking at a company like Research in Motion, I was watching Fast Money and the stock was down like 25-ish, and these guys were murdering the company. It's horrible. It's terrible. Apple's eating their lunch. It's, you know, but when you look at the fundamentals and you look what happened to the company went down 50%. I mean, it lost 50% of its value, which is accounting for most of those risks. There's like 30 some odd. Institutional analyst covering the stock, and I took the person who hates the stock the most, and that was Deutsche Bank. And based on their earning estimate, based on them, they hate the stock the most. The stock was trading at seven times earnings, which is a 40% discount to the S&P 500. And you look at it now, it's at 32. So if I could tell anybody out there, be careful about the headlines. I mean, the headlines are there to make you read the stories. Again, people get paid by how many clicks you read, how many views you're watching. I mean, CNBC is not going to say, well, the market's okay today. It's not really going on. No, yeah. There has to be someone saying, this is an enormous buying opportunity. You need the Altucher's coming on saying, you know, we're going to go to 20,000. Or you need the Rubini saying it's like 2008 and the world's going to end. That's what they want to see. So just be careful when you read the headlines.
So what you're saying is CNBC is not going to say, hey, it's calm day. Turn off your TV. Go to the beach.
You know what CNBC is not going to say? Exactly. They're not going to say that, okay, you have European problems and you know, we're on a verge of recession. But you know what? In the same sentence, they're not going to say things like balance sheets are stronger than ever. Insiders are buying stock at the biggest pace since March 2009. Companies buying back more stock already this year than all of 2009. They're not going to tell you that earnings last quarter grew 17%, which is not bad considering more than 25% of the S&P 500 is trading below 10 times forward earnings. So, you know, they're not going to tell you both sides of the story. They want to be either one way or the other because that's what attracts viewers. So just from an investment purpose, you know, just look at the fundamentals, look at it, and look what's going on. I mean, we have a million risks out there. We hear about them every day. But just keep in mind, stocks are down a lot in August. So there's a lot of good buying opportunities out there.
I hear you. I hear you. You know, but at the same time, you know, Frank, you know that I am not a really big PE kind of guy. Right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I mean, as a matter of fact, I think PE is a wonderful tool. At the same time, I'm very skeptical about it because I think that it relies on analysts who oftentimes are either overly optimistic or overly pessimistic, and you don't get a real number till after the fact. So when things are going really well with the company, you get the earnings number and the projection, and what happens there is that you're looking at a number that may be a little bit out of whack. Just look, for example, at what happened last week with much of the economic numbers that came out. You know, analysts started lowballing things like the ISM manufacturing, and it came out better, so all of a sudden everybody was in and then just blew it out when they realized it wasn't so good. They were way out of whack on employment, which I find fascinating. How are they so off on employment numbers?
You know, it's difficult to say. I mean, you know, a lot of employment has to do with sentiment, and you can't gauge sentiment no matter who the hell you are. I don't care, you know, especially economists, because those people don't even talk to people. I mean, those guys are locked themselves in a room and look at charts and statistics all day. But when you're looking at it, it kind of makes sense. I know it was a terrible number. I know we're losing jobs. You're not losing jobs. We had zero. And you know, the bulls will say, well, a lot of that was Verizon, which is like 45,000 in telecom. 47,000 lost jobs. But you know what? We kind of lost jobs in manufacturing, construction, and government as well. So it's definitely a weak number no matter which way you look at it. But put yourself in the shoes of a business owner. I mean, last month, you know, especially the last 2 months, we're talking about what the debt ceiling. The politicians have no clue what they were doing. I mean, they're high-fiving each other on $2.3 trillion when we have $14 trillion in debt. Obviously, that's why we got the S&P downgrade. For U.S. debt, you're looking at a stock market that absolutely collapsed. You're looking at European problems. As a business owner, you know, you're saying, you know what, let me not, you know, I don't want to, even if things are good, you know, you just want to take a wait and see approach of what's going on. And that's what's happened. That's what's reflected in the numbers, which is normal. I mean, that's, you know, even myself, when you're seeing these markets come down, I'm telling my wife, hey, you know, and believe me, like every husband out there knows, when your wife's happy, the family's happy. And she's like looking at Groupon every day and buying vacations, which is cool. And I'm like, you know what, maybe we should just, you know, hold off a little bit. That's what a lot of people are saying out there, saying, you know, hold off a little bit. And that's what this is a reflection of when it comes to sentiment. I think that's why they're so off on their numbers.
Well, you know, you mentioned something, and you mentioned a few different things there. And you mentioned that, you know, when you the job losses, and you mentioned that when I, you know, we're not making any job, you know, we're not creating any jobs, I should say. And all of this is really interesting because, in a way, we're getting very mixed signals from the administration, who just keeps on saying how great everything is. Miraculously, by the way, the White House came out with projections of their unemployment rate on Thursday, which I thought was interesting. Didn't do much for the markets, the 8.5% to 9% range, they said. And there was this great optimism that there would be some kind of miracle pulled off, and that, you know, there would be some hiring. And I think the realization is that there is a lot of concern. And just like you talk to your wife or maybe your kids or whoever it is, or your friends or colleagues, I think everybody's saying similar things, that there's a lot of headwinds here. I'll tell you something. You know, by the way, for those of you who don't know, Frank is very excited about these discussions. He works for Stansberry's Research. He writes a variety of different newsletters. Great researcher. And if you haven't subscribed to any of his work, you really must. But Frank is passionate. So you got two crazy New Yorkers on the line here talking about a passionate area of theirs. But, you know, one of the things that really is very I think that is very concerning and disturbing is the lack of transparency through Europe, number one. And the second thing is that it almost appears that investors are being led into an experiment and, you know, kind of with a hook in the mouth. And the government doesn't really have any practical experience with what they've done, and the amount of money they've thrown away is extraordinary. And, you know, I think that once the average Joe gets aware of the, wow, what, that didn't really work so well, like QE2, QE3 is not going to have the same effect, and the government carrot is not going to have the same effect.
Well, I can tell you this. You use the word experiment, and they have tried this before. And I'm just saying that whether you're bull or bear, I don't care if you're a Democrat or Republican. This is just, you know, I'm going to throw out some facts for you here. We've only seen interest rates this low relatively two times in our history. We've seen it right after, you know, post-war, 1945, 46, 47. We had a terrible period in the markets, and then we pushed rates exceptionally low. And then we had mortgage rates, I think, at 4.5%, and it resulted in one of the biggest housing booms in history in the 1950s. Again, we went through a period that was absolutely terrible. We look at 2001, when we came off the internet boom, and you know, stocks crashed. Everybody knows the story. Then we had September 11th. We began lowering interest rates in 2001, and it took till 2005 before that actually impacted the market. And we all know what happened. We had one of the biggest booms in market history, and you know, everything hit all-time highs. Of course, you know, you could see what happened with the consequences of that, where we had little regulation, and everybody knows that story as well. But what the Fed's trying to do with QE3 is basically buy time, because usually, you know, people are going to say, well, it doesn't work, it doesn't work. Well, you don't want the market crashing in the middle of when you have the lowest interest rates in history, where in history it's proven that low interest rates creates booming economies for the U.S. I mean, we won't go to Japan. Japan is a totally different animal. I mean, they have, you know, in 2002, they had a population of 127 million people. Today, they have a population of 126 million people. I mean, it's a totally different animal, and people are going to cite, you know, Japan to the U.S. But usually when we have periods of low interest rate, it results in an enormous economic boom, and that's what the government is hoping for. Whether it's going to happen or not, who knows? But the alternative is, if you sit there and do nothing, you could see, you know, we have to pay interest on these debt payments, and if interest rates go higher, we're in a lot of trouble. I mean, those debt payments become huge. So I could see where the government's coming from with QE3. Will it work? I don't know. But I understand. You have to understand that when we have periods of low interest rates, it usually results in a huge economic boom. It hasn't happened yet. Doesn't mean it's not going to happen in the future. But something to look forward to. I think that's where the Fed's head's at.
But the problem you have here, Frank, is something that I think everybody is starting to wonder about. If you have already put the pedal to the metal with regard to your interest rate policy being zero, you can't go negative. Let's just talk about that. And say that. And if there are no other policies available, take, for example, what Brazil did last week. Brazil has been raising interest rates for the last several, many, many months to try to tame their inflation, which has been a direct hit from our situation over here. And, you know, the bottom line is that they had the ability to actually bring down their rates as the economy was slowing. We don't have that ability right now. So the of course that the Fed says, I mean, can you imagine if the Fed said we have no more tools left? That's not going to work. So the Fed says we have plenty of tools left just to either bamboozle us, to lead us on, or maybe it's true. But what are the tools? They have QE. They have the ability to move out on the yield curve to buy that. They also have the ability to print more money and devalue our money. They also have the ability to you know, adjust some of the banking deposit issues. And all that. What else do they have? It's a monetary policy. That's it.
They're telling them, you know, selling short-term bonds, buying long-term bonds, help interest low. But realize one of the things that you said, which is really crazy. Again, I'm not agreeing with anything that they're doing here, but the power to print money is enormous. I mean, they obviously know they could print money forever and just spark programs, put it towards infrastructure, which has never worked based on every study I've ever read. I've done a lot of homework on this, that, you know, trying to provide money for infrastructure, it just doesn't create jobs. I don't know why they continue to push us down the road, and maybe that will have to – that might be factored into QE3 down the road. But the fact that they just continue to print money is really a crazy thought. But that's – I mean, for people to say, well, the Fed's out of bullets or – you know, they're not out of bullets. They could print money for every, you know, they could print money forever. So there's other things they could do. I don't want to see them do it. However, they're probably going to go with QE3 based on the latest round of economic data, which shows that, you know, we're not really growing. And keep in mind, the only, and I mean the only solution to our problems right now is either default or we have massive economic growth. I mean, that's it. I mean, I don't know if default would be a solution, but those are the only two outcomes right now. So, you know, they're going to put the, you know, pedal to the metal and keep printing money and try to inflate this economy and try to build this economy so we can work off our debts. That's their goal. I don't know if it's going to work, though, like I said.
All right, I could tell you this. Ready? I am bored with the discussion of the Fed already because it's crap.
Yeah, I was just going to say. We always get the stocks and fun stuff.
Forget this. First of all, I want to kind of backtrack on a few different things. There was a big drop in markets, and we almost saw I guess in a way it could be called like a slow motion crash. I mean, we saw a very big drop for equity values. Individual stocks got whacked by 40-50% across the board for much of the small cap universe. And we also saw, you know, banks just getting obliterated. what's happening? Your world of stocks under 10 and small caps, talk to me a little bit about that. Are you seeing that there is a bit of a shunning of those and there is an extra hard movement down? Because it did remind me of what happened in 2008 and back in 2001 and all. I mean, there was big, big moves.
A very big move. And it wasn't even that long of a period. As I said earlier, it was like 2.5 weeks. But you know, you want to try to go to pockets of strength. There's two things you want to do. You want to play defense, obviously. So you want to limit your losses through stop losses. And people say, well, you know, stop losses, if the market comes back. I mean, think of playing a Texas Hold'em tournament in poker. When you lose your money, you're gone. You're out. That's it. I mean, if you look at the professionals, they keep their money on the table as long as they can. Even when they have good hands or they think they have good stocks, you know, they continue to play it. But when they feel like it's not there, they're out. And then they play again. So with the market, you want to be able to protect those losses, because when these stocks do come down 40%, instead of losing all your money, if you cut your losses at, say, a 20%, 15% stop loss, now you have money to buy these stocks when they're down 45, 50%, which are, you know, you're seeing stocks that had incredible earnings. It was just a general market sell-off. Didn't matter about fundamentals, anything. It's just, you know, stocks just sold off. But there's a lot of good companies trading, you know, at very cheap valuations, at least in my area of the market, which we're starting to pick away at. And I think that a lot of these companies, a bottom, may have a little bit more risk there. But wow, I mean, when they're down 40, 45%, came out with fantastic quarters, are cheap and have good balance sheets, it makes me think, well, you know, this could be 2008, but March 2009 was a great opportunity to buy stocks, where if you bought almost any small cap, you're probably up 100 to 150%.
Yeah, I mean, and the other thing is, there seems to be this incredible buy the dip mentality that just will not go away. And the question I have on that is, if all the money's being ripped out of mutual funds over the last several months, and there is an incredible amount of squeezing going on for credit, where is all the money coming from?
No, you know what? It's a good question. It really is a good question. I just think, you know, 2008 is fresh in everybody's mind. And you're looking at, especially as you know, because, you know, you manage money probably for retirees as well. You know, they're looking at their home values declined 35, 40% in some places. You're looking at them losing half of their 401ks, and they don't have working power. You know, when you see a market correct 25% in a couple of weeks, 20%, you know, they're out. They're gone. They're like, no, I can't do this. I can't do this again. So, you know, and then when you see that total capitulation, like, yeah, I mean, AOL, should AOL be trading at $10? I mean, that's how far AOL came down, to $10. It jumped 50% immediately. I think it's like $14, $15 immediately. So you're going to see the overreactions. But then I think you're going to see money come back into the market where people say, okay, wait a minute. You know, every single bank in the world is not going to collapse, especially in the U.S., which was the case in 2008. I mean, we were borderline Armageddon back then. It's not the case. Right now, we're factoring a mild recession at best. And maybe we do go in recession. It's anybody's debate. But it's not 2008. I think when people know that, they're going to be like, okay, maybe I want to buy Intel, Microsoft, or you know, 25% of the S&P 500 under 10 times earnings. I mean, which is not bad. And you know, you mentioned PE ratio before. You can't use PE ratio as a standalone basis. Otherwise, you're going to be in value traps. You have to look at companies that are growing. And that's why I mentioned the S&P 500. The earnings were growing 17%. You throw in a PE that's 10. That's pretty good. You know, you think you're getting good value there. As long as you have the growth, you have to look at growth along with PE ratios.
I agree with you with that, but the problem comes in is really trying to figure out two things. What is the appropriate PE? And that's a judgment call based on sentiment, because we don't know what that is. You know, different times of the economic cycle, that changes. But the second thing is, you know, there has been a lot of very, I think, I don't know if it's confusing, but it's contradictory discussions of companies. You know, you're seeing some companies say, in the same space, by the way, that there is great opportunities and great orders. Another like, well, China's dried up to nothing. I mean, and it's kind of like, wait a minute. One guy is doing this. The other guy's doing that. And then the other thing is that once you see a story that is negative, I mean, they are just obliterating those stocks.
You know what's sad, too, is you have to pick a side. Like, say for China, you know, you have people saying that, you know, inflation's out of control. It's out of control in China. And that's cool if that's your argument. But you know what? What did China do? They raised rates and what? They brought inflation down. They're seeing, you know, slower growth, right? PMI pulling back. But then you have the same guys going, China is slowing down. And, you know, they're, you know, that's the country that's, you know, where the growth's coming from in India. And now that they're slowing it, I mean, you have to, you know, China did a fantastic job. I mean, their policies go through a lot quicker than ours. Doesn't mean they're a better economy. It's just that, you know, when they decide if they want to put a highway in there, they just decide, hey, you know what? They call 1,000 people and say, you know, we'll longer live in those houses. I mean, we don't do that here. We vote on stuff. But they get policies done a lot quicker, and they pull the reins back a lot quicker, which you have to give them credit for. But now I think if they wanted to, they could spark their economy pretty quickly. So, you know, you have to pick a side. Either you don't like China because of inflation, or you don't like China because it's slow growth, but you can't have both of them. And I think that's what you see with the headlines, when people are negative no matter what.
Right. And the other thing is that you have to realize that a lot of times, like a Jim Chanos, I mean, if he was really fully invested in his Chinese thesis, he'd be hurting pretty badly. I mean, his housing market went down, up pretty well on the short there and all, and then it came back. I mean, again, we don't know exactly what he holds. We don't know exactly what it is. So you got to kind of take all that with a grain of salt. The other thing is that China has said over and over that they're trying to really increase the yuan and trying to, as a matter of fact, last week just talked about how even if manufacturing and growth stalls, we are going to continue with our inflation process. Now, again, the whole rhetoric game, look at about Japan. I mean, how many times did Japan say, hey, we're watching from the sidelines very closely the value of the yen? And they're like, yeah. And not do anything. And then they're like, well, if it starts moving, we're going to really consider something. It's like, what? And they don't do anything. This is like 10 times they did this until they finally threw out the prime minister, right? And I think that this whole rhetoric game is something that is getting very old. But in terms of China, I think there's a very two-sided situation. There's no question that there's a population growth there and no population growth needs and all. But the question then is, you know, are they betting on the wrong ship? Because they are really, really supporting Europe.
No, they are supporting Europe. I agree with that. I mean, the facts show they're supporting Europe. But I think that, you know, if you really visit China and you come from the U.S. and visit China, which, you know, you've done as well, you really see that how many people actually live there. Like, we always throw out the number 1.3 billion. It's almost 1.4 billion. But, you know, we only have, what, 300 million, a little bit more than that, of our population here. I mean, think of that. And these people are making more money. These people save their money. They pay cash for everything. You know, so a good way to play this growth is do it through the Dow components, I think, that have exposure. Don't go to a small cap area. I've made my mistakes there because there's no transparency. And even the ones that are getting it right, there's just no institutional support. And you're going to get a blog come out and say negative things on whatever. And there's no support there because of everything that's happened. If you're seeing, you know, companies like Yahoo and Alibaba and the CEO making side deals for a company that big, and also Sinopharis, which is a very big company, it's a scary market. So I'd probably stick to the Dow components to invest in China, which leaves you, you know, with Cummins and you know, there's just a number of them in the Dow that you know, even
you can
even
also
that,
use Baidu, you could use Sina, you can use those.
Yeah, Deer, you know, just a ton of companies.
Yeah, the thing is that Sinopharis, by the way, was really fascinating in that. You know, a couple of big guys got taken for a total of about close to $1 billion. I mean, that's just the two.
Well, look, Andrew, this podcast is about learning. So I'm going to tell you about my experience because everybody, I'm sure you have people on this podcast all the time, and I do as well when I host my podcast, the SNA Investor Podcast, and people always talk about their winners. I'm going to talk about one of the big mistakes that I made. I went to China. I sat down with the CEO and CFOs of these management teams. I made sure they had a qualified auditor, either a very good auditor in China or one that was very good over here. I visited their plants, which were real. I saw the people that work there. I saw trucks come in and everything. And then I also, when I came back here before recommending these companies, I made sure the insiders had a stake in the company, 25-35% ownership. And you know what? These guys were still doing side deals that nobody knew about.
Really?
So just think about that with China, which was a big wake-up call for me. But, you know, if you're looking to invest in small caps China, you know, I thought I got it right. I did the due diligence. I paid the money to go to China for 2 weeks and visit six different cities. And you know what? These guys sat down with them, shook their hand, great guys. And you know what? They were making some kind of crazy deals that nobody else knows about. So, and I don't even know why they were doing it because they own 25-30% of the company. So I have no idea, but that's just to tell you what happens in China and why you really have to be careful.
Right. I want to skip over to the banking sector in the U.S. We could talk about Europe and all that, but the banking sector in U.S. is kind of interesting. We had that crazy situation where out of nowhere, Warren Buffett comes up with $5 billion for a preferred issue of Bank of America, gets a sweetheart deal on warrants that are just amazing. This is right after Moynihan comes out and says, you know what, we don't need to raise capital. And then just right after he does this, then sells off a piece of the China Construction Bank, then sells off a piece of the mortgage correspondence business. And the stock goes haywire, of course, because a lot of shorts in there and people are – listen, there's a lot of people that want to be in Bank of America and make money on it because they just – you know, they lost so much over time. What's your take on this whole sector right now, specifically the ones that are hurting the most? And then on top of that, please answer the second question, which is now it seems to me that the government doesn't really care as much if they do some real damage to these companies because they're coming after them left and right, like the Goldman lawsuit and the mortgage lawsuits last week.
Well, they are coming after them, but they're always going to keep them afloat. But in terms of Moynihan, look, you know, picture you're the CEO of a bank. The last thing you would ever say is it's political suicide to say we need to raise capital. I mean, the guy's doing his job saying we don't need to raise capital, and, you know, they're obviously raising capital. So, you know, people are faulting Moynihan. I don't know him personally. I mean, really, the guy's just been given like a tough hand, I believe. I don't know if he could have changed anything else. Maybe he could have raised money when the stock was a lot higher. But who knows what's going to happen in the future. As far as the whole banking sector, look, we know about the regulations. We know how tough they are. We knew about the mortgage exposure for 5-6 years. Interest rates are at record lows. We're seeing a lot of markets bottoming out. You're not going to hear that because they report on a national level. And a lot of you look in New York, you're going to be bidding for a house right now. If you're looking in Queens or in Long Island, you're going to be bidding for a house. In Florida, we've seen, you know, I'm seeing activity pick up in my area as well. Some areas, obviously, are terrible, but there's a lot of markets. I mean, looking at interest rates low, I mean, look where they are. You know, mortgage rates. I mean, if you have the money to buy a house at what, under 4.5, 4.25 mortgage rates, I mean, oof, it doesn't get any better than that. But, and also home prices are down 30-35% still. So you're looking at a market, if we could just see stabilization, I think you see it better for the banks. Right now, you're looking at these companies trading, I mean, you can't read what's on their balance sheets, you know, and you look at tangible book value. So that means, you know, if the company was sold off, that's how much money they would get. And I think what at Bank of America is like a 12. So I don't know how much you believe that. But at 6, you know, I kind of like Warren Buffett's decision. You could read 1,000 articles saying it has nothing to do with the common, but it does provide some sense of security. Also, when you have, you know, perma bears, kind of perma bears like Dick Bovee's bank analyst, Meredith Winnie, come out and kind of defend Bank of America, too. I think that's the key to the whole market. I think if you really see financials stabilize, if you see Bank of America stabilize, I mean, it did go over 8 last week and now it's pulling back. But if we have some stabilization there, I think we could find some kind of bottom for this market and be okay investing. But as long as you're seeing those big banks really, you know, it just makes you think 2008. And that's a problem getting more new money in here.
Yeah, I want to get to in a minute what an individual investor should be looking for. But I just want to talk about Dick Bovee for a second. If you pull up a we could do this. We pulled up a history of Dick Bovee's calls on Bank of America, when to buy, when to sell. Okay? I looked back the last 3 years or so. There are no sells. Let's just get that straight.
But he did actually say to sell all the banks about.
That
he
was
had
not
one
direct,
recall.
Though. That was not direct. That was, not direct, that was a few weeks ago.
Yeah, he came on CNBC like, I think, and I'm not, you know, whatever. But I don't really, you know, he's got, he's, I don't know, he's probably more wrong than right. I hate to say that about any analyst, but it's true. But I know he had one good call, but he said you have to avoid banks. I think it was in May, and now he's saying to buy Bank of America. But overall, I'm glad that you did this because it's important to look at someone's track record before you listen to them and invest according to what they say.
I mean, he's bought every single time. I mean, every time he comes out, he's a buy, it's a buy, it's a buy. All his research, all the way down. So you know what? One good time that you say to get out, by the way, which was it was a cataclysmic, world-ending commentary that he's got to get out of everything. And by the way, he switched over a matter of weeks later to say that, yeah, now it's time to buy Bank of America. So I'm not sure what that is, you know, where he's going with this and what he's trying to do. But that I just find that, you know, a guy who's going to take you down, you know, 80% on a stock, first of all, is going to be right every once in a while. I mean, if he's going to make
everybody is.
If he's going to make 50 calls, one of them's going to
yep,
be right.
Absolutely.
So I just, you know, be aware that, you know, you have to realize the timing of things on the different television stations. And when they bring them on, it's usually either too late or, you know, you have to question what's going on there. What's the story with individuals? And I think there's a lot of shell shock going on out there. So let's kind of just break this down to, you know, what to be looking at right now and be concerned about, because I think a lot of people look at the employment numbers. That's a key thing that they look at, which is important. And, you know, what are you seeing in the manufacturing? What are you seeing in the retail? What are you seeing in the economy? And what should an individual person, that person listening right now, what should they kind of take away from that?
You should take away from when you see these numbers and you see the headlines, it's what's happened a couple of months ago. I mean, they're lagging indicators. You want to see what's going to go on in the future. So we've had a decent run, a decent rally. We may get better economic statistics later on. But a lot of the indicators are lagging indicators. So they're reporting things that happened a month or two ago. So, you know, we had the big Verizon strike. We had, you know, the whole debt ceiling debate. And, of course, if you're a business owner, like I said earlier, you know, you're not really going to do too much. But as an individual, look at homes in your neighborhood. Are they beginning to sell? Look at jobs. Look at, you know, if you have teenagers, are they starting to get jobs? That's a tough market. You know, are people hiring in your neighborhood? Your working hours. One thing that was surprising to me, which is a real negative in the jobs report, we saw the hourly earnings and also incomes drop. That's mm-hmm. a real negative. So you want to be able to see, you know, how hard are you working? I mean, most people that I know, at least from my podcast and what I hear, my feedback, people are really working harder than ever. It's just people, you know, you're looking at businesses, they do not want to hire new people because of the healthcare expense. They rather pay a little bit more in overtime. It just doesn't pay. So I see the unemployment rate staying at 9% for a very, very long time, at least in the 8 to 10% range in a long time, which doesn't mean, you know, it's a terrible environment for stocks. It just means that, you know, productivity is through the roof, and if businesses see more demand, they're just pushing that work onto existing employees. So, you know, things to look for within yourself is, you know, how hard you're working. Are they pushing more jobs? Is your company doing good? Are they laying off? And that gives you a better sense of the economy, because that's, you know, that's really what it's all about.
You know, one of the things that we do here over at Horowitz and Company is we have to, at least that I like to, and I've taught this in my books too, and I've spoken to this many times at conferences, that it's really important to write things down. Now, you may say, well, I know what I want to do. Sometimes writing things down, as mundane as this may sound, is really good to clear your thoughts and to have a history of what you've done, and also to be able to craft something with a good set of parameters. So each day we write a lot for the blogs. And by the way, just a side note, if you haven't done so already, the whole entire month of September, we are actually opening up our private client blog. Every day that we write, we're putting it, the entire publication of that, on thedisciplinedinvestor.com for free. And you can check that out. And that's going to be for the month of September. And you know what's in October, Frank?
What's in October?
Stocktoberfest.
Does that mean you're recommending a lot of stocks? Or?
Well, we're going to have a discussion of various stocks. I asked our listeners to send in their stock symbols if they want, and we will do an analysis of each of the stocks, put our one sheet up there, commentary about a stock a day. Stocktoberfest.
That's cool.
Anyway, so the thing is that I sent you our report last night, the internal report, Frank, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the things I talked about was this whole productivity and the overall, we talked about the average hourly wages, et cetera, and the unit labor cost. Now, one of the things that I found was kind of interesting and frankly surprising was that productivity has been trailing down over the last 6-7 months pretty dramatically, but unit labor costs are going up. That usually will be the case, by the way, because the lower productivity means that you're not able to get the product out, which means more time and more expense to do so. Therefore, unit labor costs go up. That usually will be the case. But what it states differently than you heard on CNBC yesterday is that employers are not desirous of hiring. And what's happened is that input prices are going up and they're not selling as much because there's not that many orders and they're not getting as much bang for their buck out of the employee. So why in the world would they hire more? Right?
No, I definitely agree. I mean, like I said, I see the unemployment rate between 8-10%. I don't, you know, if you're a business owner, why, you know, most business owners that I talk to aren't really hiring right now. And even though they're seeing good demand and I hear from their employees and they're saying that, I'm working my butt off here. You know, they're working like crazy. They're really not hiring. They don't have an incentive to hire. There's just not an incentive out there.
Yeah, no, there's, and now we have, I laugh because when I think about this, I find it, it's not humorous. I laugh out of just, I don't know. It's like a nervous laugh, I guess. The 7th was supposed to have a speech, a big jobs, or at least some kind of resolution or discussion, and from the president. The president requested to have a joint session of Congress on the 7th to present something, obviously. And he sent a letter, and Boehner said no.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, we have other plans. And one of the reasons was they had another vote, another thing going on that day, and also there was some kind of a security sweep they'd have to do, so I guess Obama came in on the 8th. But, you know, once again, by the way, that small issue, that very minor issue that was obviously just talked about on the press and just blown up to out of proportion, just the inability for the president's office, the White House, to coordinate with the Congress and know what's going on beforehand and avoid these kind of little errors, I think it leaves a really bad taste and an uncertainty and unsettling feeling in a lot of people, don't you think?
No, I think so. I think people are just fed up with the politics as well. I mean, I've never seen it so nasty. in politics, where they're not even concerned with finding a solution. They're just concerned with telling, you know, the other side what's wrong. And again, not taking sides of Republican and Democrat here. It's just, you know, if they tell Obama that, you know, he's not creating jobs for small businesses, and he announces a job for small businesses, they're like, it's not good enough. It's horrible. You're still terrible. So, you know, it's just it's really cutthroat politics right now. It's very difficult, but I don't think these guys take a step back and look at what you know, the people see. And it's kind of a joke. I mean, it's such nonsense. I mean, you know, when more and more people turn to Fox Business News, you know, because they hate politics. I mean, it's not really a good thing.
Right.
In my opinion.
Yeah. The other thing is that we have, unfortunately, in place an overwhelming amount of academics that are running things. And, you know, we always talked about being from New York. You have the difference. All right. What's the difference between street knowledge and what's the difference between book knowledge and all that? You need the book knowledge in life to get along, but you need the street smarts, and you need that kind of that knowledge factor to make it and maybe be successful. You can't just have one or the other. There's a mix. And one of the problems that it seems to be is that there's a lot of academia that is running things, and we are having a backup of understanding of what it is that business owners do, expect, will do in certain circumstances versus, okay, historically, monetary policy easing has worked to increase the da-da-da-da, and we will do this step. I mean, we need to think a little bit out of the box and get creative here, because if not, we're just going to keep on making the same mistakes over and over.
Well, it's difficult for politicians. That's why I kind of like Paul Ryan's plan. Again, you know, not because he's a Republican or not, you know, not Democrat or anything. It's just, it's actually a politician that said, look, you know, we have to cut entitlements. And we have to cut entitlements, but it's political suicide for any politician to say that. But in the end, you're going to have to do that. And we don't have a choice. I mean, we could start today, I mean, and leave everything in place for retirees now and make the change today. For the younger generation, which, you know, which is me. So it's fine if we need to cut deficits, but there has to be some kind of a plan in place to cut entitlements. And I know my mom is a retiree, and she tells me this all the time and says, I can't, they're not going to cut that on the, you know, they're not going to cut these, you know, Medicaid and everything. And you know, it's terrible to say, and I don't think they're going to cut them for the people who existing, but there needs to be something done, because they just, you know, they're black holes.
Holes,
and they're going to be black holes going forward.
Here's the problem. You have two and maybe even three distinct groups that are getting Medicare, Medicaid. You know, we're talking about retirees and Social Security. And one group is the group that needs it. You know, and we could just identify whatever that is, right? There's one group that needs it. They, for whatever reason, you know, whether it's their fault or not, I'm not really going up that street, but basically they need it. There's another group that, they need it. You know, they could get along maybe without it. They maybe have enough income, but if they do, they're going to spend down their principal. All right, so let's put that in the middle group. And then you have the group that doesn't need it at all, will never need it, has never needed it, but gets it anyway. Now, I have talked to several people in the group of never needed it, getting Social Security anyway. Without it, life would be just dandy. They wouldn't skip a beat. They'd never even know if they – it's a rounding error. They wouldn't know. And I said, hey, I think that it would be interesting to consider those people that are earning over a certain amount of income, that they would either get a much, much higher tax on their Social Security or inclusion, or stop it altogether. And you know what their answer was? Absolutely not. We are entitled to that money. We put it in. That is our money that we are getting back. I would have not given the money to the government if it was due to the fact that I said, wait a minute, you give money to the government all the time through income tax, and you have no idea if it benefits you. So, but they're adamant. I mean, adamant that they're not going to, you know, allow the government to take their money and then get nothing back from it. Now, if we have that attitude, Frank, if we have the attitude that, hey, I deserve this, I earned this, it's mine, how are we ever going to get ahead? Because we've already screwed the whole process up by giving things like houses to people that shouldn't have gotten it.
The only solution is to get a politician in there that doesn't really care about his job, and that's never going to happen. But yeah, and again, not to get into, you know, we went over politics, economy. I'm sure we're going to get a lot of emails on that, but There's actually one thing I did want to talk about, if you don't mind, is
your baby, your kid.
Forget it. Those kids, two kids under three. Oh, crazy, crazy time for me right now. But anyway, I there's a research project I've been doing that it's fascinating. It's one of the most important research projects I've ever done in my life, and it's on DNA sequencing. And for those of you who aren't familiar with it, basically you can get your DNA sequenced and they give you, you know, a list of every single type of disease. And based on, you know, your genome, they could determine the chances of you getting this disease in the future. So you could actually prevent it by knowing what you're at the highest risk for. Now, to get this done, 10 years ago, it was $100 million. Now it's under $10,000, and I just got it done. Me and a couple guys at my company, and it's absolutely fascinating. And the costs for this are going to be less than $1,000. There's a lot of different stocks out there. I'm not even going to promote my newsletter on this because this isn't about newsletters. It's just something I think everybody should be a part of. It's absolutely fascinating. I think when it comes down to $1,000, why wouldn't you want to know that? Because you want to live longer. This way you can see your kids grow up. Every billionaire you know, well, not every billionaire, but you're looking at, you know, Gates, Warren Buffett, institutions like Harvard, Yale, MIT, seeing companies with the biggest balance sheets in the world, Google, IBM, Intel, they're all behind this, putting a ton of money behind this. And I think it's something that's fascinating. I just identified five stocks for my newsletter, which have incredible potential. It's something, again, I'm not even going to promote my newsletter because I'm so excited about this. I think everybody should do it. But I think that it's fascinating. I think these stocks did get hit hard, which are creating an enormous buying opportunity. And I think that that's one of the areas of the market which you should be looking at now. And I want to throw that in about stocks because we just really talked politics.
Well, no,
and
but healthcare is interesting because in the area of health – now, first of all, in a market correction, all bets are off. Let's just get that off the table, okay? We know that. But let's just talk about the longer-term situation where you do have an aging population not only here but around the world, and there are some amazing drugs that are coming up and procedures and processes, et cetera, that are – you know, going to be great. Now, you have to weigh that with what's going on around the world. I mean, like Spain recently said, you know what? No more name brand prescriptions. We're not paying for them. The government, I don't know if you know about that, Frank.
No, I didn't know about
just,
that.
Just I think it was last week or the two weeks ago. And, you know, generics okay, so maybe, oh, that's interesting. But, you know, the austerity measures that are going on around the world are, aside from the fact they're not working, but they are aimed to cutting the cost of or the expense for the government. So they're looking at all sorts of options. And but yeah, I agree with you that you have an aging population. I'm going to throw you a real curveball here, and I'm probably going to really piss off my listeners right now. One of the problems we have in the world, now, this is not, I'm not doing anything about this, nor do I making any kind of a moral statement here. I'm just saying a fact based on the statistics, okay? There are too many people in the world, and there are too many people that are getting older because we didn't plan properly actuarially for any of this. So by extending life, which is a good thing, extending life, we kind of get ourselves even to a more of a hole financially. What do you think about that?
So what are you suggesting? Everybody should commit suicide?
No, we have like a deer hunt. We have a culling. No, seriously, no, what I'm saying. No, I'm just saying, again, I'm not saying anything that can be or should be done about it. All I'm saying is that factually, the numbers say that there are too many people, and they're getting old, and they're living too long. That's all I'm saying. There's nothing that can be done for it or should be done for that. It's just a fact. Mm-hmm. We need the actuarial numbers to change, and you know, so medicine, you have to here's the point. You have to realize that medicine will make advancements because people have the innate desire to live as long as possible. And that being the case, we need to put our heads together and think logically on how to plan for our futures financially because the equation is that if your money runs out before you die, that is not a good thing.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
Yeah, you know? So I think that is something we need to look at. Well, let's talk about, though, some of the areas of, you know, under 10 and some of the things that you're researching. So we talk about the genetic issue and the DNA sequencers. And do I even want to know what they found on yours? How many chromosomes do you have?
No, everything worked out okay. I was a little nervous because they said there was a glitch in the system and said that I need to contact my health care service provider. So I was a little nervous. But one of the things that did come up is a skin cancer. It said that from the sun and UV that the average is 35%. Mine came in at 55%, was relatively high. And I live in Florida. And the reason, and I just got these results back last week. And it's fascinating because, you know, now I know that I have a high risk for that, and I like to play golf. And sometimes I'll go out there and be like, you know what, I want to tan today. You know, now I'm going to be wearing a hat, 50 sunscreen. You know, I've learned to surf down here. Now I surf with a shirt on. But, you know, stuff like that, like things that you could see you're high risk for and be able to prevent it. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, and I don't know, this is me personally, I don't want to live past 70. I really don't. I mean, I don't want anybody taking care of me, and I'm probably going to be in a lot
70,
of
70, okay.
You know what I mean?
80, 80. Give yourself 80.
You know, like 70, 80, okay, fine. But, you know, that's just my personal belief, and people could laugh at that. But, you know, I'm not one of the people who say, I want to live to 150. I don't, you know. But I do want to live a long enough time to see my kids grow up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the fact that, you know, that's a big difference where, you know, something I didn't know, I think it's fantastic. And if when this goes to like $1,000, you're going to see, I mean, hundreds of millions of people do this because it just makes sense just to find out, you know, what you could do to prevent the, you know, some of the diseases that you get. I mean, diabetes and every single disease that you can prevent, prostate cancer and stuff like that. Just if you have, you know, your high percentage of getting that, you're going to do a lot more today and exercise more than doing that. But, you know, getting back to your original question, what am I looking at? And it is a difficult environment, but one of the things I like are mid-cap to small-cap gold and silver producers. You have three different segments here. You have junior miners, which don't produce, you know, gold and silver, very speculative. However, since they're not producing, they're not able to take advantage of the higher metal prices. Then you have the large caps. Which
well, back up. Why aren't they producing?
They're called junior miners. What they do is they go, they stake a claim, they find gold, right, and they try to find partners and JV partners, right, and it takes like 3 to 5 years to develop. So they're not actually producing gold, but they do say, you know, based on our studies and all 3D sites, you know, the data, that we have gold here. Now, those are junior miners, which could, and I've had stocks in my phase one newsletter at Stansberry go up 500% recommending these. It's very speculative. Right. I'm telling that, right, that's one speculative area. I'm looking for conservative because the market's a little crazy right now. Now, you look at the larger stocks in this area. Some of them pay a little bit of a dividend. They're able to take advantage of higher prices. They have low PEs, but they're not able to grow because they're so big. So when you're looking at the mid-cap producers, a company like Fortuna Silver, FVI.TO, trades on Toronto Exchange. Fantastic exchange, guys. It's very easy to trade there, just like the U.S. They're a mid-cap company, and they're producing a ton of silver right now and expect to produce double and triple output going forward, which I think is fantastic. So they're able to take advantage of what they're producing today and also their growth potential. You look at a company like Yamana Gold, which is producing gold and at one of the lowest cost producers. It's a mid-cap. I think it's a fantastic buy as well because the next 3 years expected to grow gold production by more than 60%. So that's some of the areas I'm looking at. I bought Yamana around $11, I think, so it's a little higher. I'd wait for these companies to pull back. There's a lot of mid to small cap tier producers that have huge growth potential. I think it's a fantastic opportunity because they make money when gold is at 1,200 and gold's at 1,900. So
I got to tell you something, Frank. The fact that gold is 1,900 again after a recent drop of 10% after the margin increase, and silver is back up to, well, it's not back up yet, but it's 42, 43.
That's high.
Which is amazing. By the way, you know, you talk about the CME and what they did recently on changing the margins and how it kind of drops things down temporarily. You know, I don't know if you're aware of this, but I think it was last week or the week before, they actually relaxed the margin on oil.
No, I didn't. You know what? That's a good point. I didn't hear that.
Yeah. And do you notice that oil went from like 80 to 90 or close to?
Yeah, but it also had to do, I think, with the it's just really like a lockstep with the market right now, too. I mean, it's down, you know, it was down, you know, later days of last week, Thursday, Friday, and it's up when the market does good. But that's interesting to see the requirements, actually.
I thought that was really interesting that they would do such a thing because that would enable greater amounts of speculation and buying and leveraging. But the gold situation is, I think, fascinating in that there is much more of a global acceptance. We are seeing central banks buy it. And the fact that if you look at bonds and what they've done and gold as what they've done, I think there is a flag up with the realization that we don't care how much we debase our currency at this point. And the fact of the matter is we are really one of the only countries around the world, really not even Europe, with their problems that are doing such a dramatic job of debasing their currency. And it's helping our sales. It's helping our exports. There's only so far that can go because that gets a little ugly around the world and you get people pretty pissed off. You know, just look at the yen. The yen is just unbelievably high at this point, almost a record high at 76 and change, which is, you know, a threefold increase over the last 20-something years. And, you know, talk about problems that currencies can have. And look what's happening with the Swiss franc, and how it's been moving. But the idea that we have now such a cheap currency, yeah, I agree that or I should say, not only cheap currency, but debasing going on, there is the belief that gold will really do very well. And even though gold has the markets have recently, you know, been coming up over the last, you know, 2 years, gold has still been doing very nicely, which is really pretty surprising.
It is surprising because when you see these moves, you think it's going to come down. And, you know, to be honest with you, I thought it would come down a little bit more. When my recommendation, even saying that, you know, buying the stocks, I just think the stocks haven't really moved along. Like lately, they've been going a little bit higher, but they're still trading 11, 12 times earnings and growing tremendously. Remember when I said, when we talked about PEs, I always look at the growth. Mm-hmm. And these two companies are growing tremendously, but they're really accounting for, I mean, you're looking at Yamana producing gold, exceptional low rate. Fortuna produces silver at $6.20. A lot of, and you brought up, one thing I wanted to bring up here real quick is you brought up the analyst estimates before and say how they could change and you know, they're all over the place. You know, that's to your advantage. Like, I pay close attention. People say, oh, you know, institutional analysis is useless. It's not useless. Here's why. Because if you could prove that they are wrong, you're going to make a lot of money because the market trades on what they say. Just like if you're looking at, you know, when they come out with earnings and they miss and the stock comes down, they miss because of the analyst estimates. If you could determine that those estimates are lower or higher, you have a significant edge of making money or losing money in a stock. So if you're looking at Fortuna Silver, they produce silver at $6.20 an ounce. It's over 40. I looked at almost all these models. They're all modeling for silver prices at below $25. You know, so if you're looking at it, their estimates are extremely low if silver prices stay above $35, and they have. So I think that, you know, it's going to be an easy beat, but that's one of the ways you can look at institutional analysis for your advantage, because a lot of times a lot of that stuff is just written to sell to other people. So, but that's one way you can use for your advantage.
Last week we had John Markman on, and we'll kind of finish up with this whole idea of where are things going. We talked about what the PEs have been, what are they going to be. John said something about, you know, the average recession. We see a 39% reduction in the value of an index, and that would lead to about, we'll say, just shy of 900, normally 882 on the S&P 500. The question is that all the data right now is clearly pointing to, you know, the potential, at least the potential for a slowdown, call it a recession, if you will. But the bigger question there is, does it matter? We are clearly seeing a slowdown that has been going on since March, even when QE2 was going on. The world is clearly slowing. We just saw the manufacturing number out of China at the lowest it's been in, I don't know, 24 months. You know, and we're seeing even Brazil get to a point that they have to stop raising their rates. And, you know, even though these analysts and these economists who you just want to punch in the face when they said it, that the Japanese earthquake wasn't going to affect anything, high oil prices wasn't going to affect anything, you know, and the economists were like, what are you talking about? What planet are you on? You can't be even thinking straight. And we see that, you know, that's coming home to roost right now. What's your best judgment in terms of the outlook over the next 6 months for the economy? Is the soft patch that, you know, because that's where they start with the whole idea of a soft patch, and they go, oh, we were wrong, it's worse. Is it going to be a continuing slowdown, or is there something out there that maybe is going to, you know, charge things up and turn things around, you know, over the next 6 months or so?
I think over the next 6 months, the next couple of months, probably going to be a week. I think we're going to have a strong ending to the year. I don't think we're going to go into recession. I don't see it. They say, well, we could talk ourselves into recession. And we can, because if you know, create enough fear out there, people stop spending and they get nervous. But, you know, the term recession is so black and white. I mean, if we really get 0.1 negative growth two quarters, that's a recession. I mean, but, you know, In 2008, we had a GDP, what was it, negative 6 point something. I mean, but yet they're both defined as a recession if we have two negative quarters. So maybe we slip into one negative quarter. I just don't see it. But I really do believe that, you know, I'm going to go with history here and say, you know, when we have interest rates this low for such a long period of time, I mean, we're risking a huge risk of inflation. We see a little bit now. It's not as bad as people project. It's going to be really terrible going forward. I think you're going to see higher prices across the board, but I do think we're going to see economic growth definitely pick up with interest rates this low. I think eventually they're going to kick in. History says eventually they do, and they don't kick in right away. But I mean, 0% Fed funds rate for 37 months, and we're printing money like crazy. It's scary. And
yeah,
I think
the problem is, Frank, it's not being loaned out. It's not being used for growth like it usually would. That's the problem. People are still trying to plug their holes. And I got to tell you something.
But where's the money going?
It's not going anywhere.
All right,
it's
but eventually being, it has to go. If they keep pushing money into it,
if
right?
If they push money into it, you know, it's
which filling, is QE3, right?
It's filling the holes that have been made by the bad mortgages, the foreclosures, the assets that have basically disappeared. And that's why after recession, traditionally, especially with a low interest rate environment, what happens is that you get back to at least the zero line within a relatively short period of time, within 2 years, of where your total GDP was, not on a percentage basis, but total gross domestic product. Let's not even talk about how the government overstated by over $400 billion over the last year and a half what the GDP was, and they said, oops, I'm sorry.
They predicted
4%
right now.
Hmm?
They predicted 4% in 2009, that our GDP would be 4%.
They're out of their minds. They're not only the projections were wrong, but their actual accounting was wrong of the GDP. But we had a 0.3 when they said it was a 0.1 on the final revision after we saw the final revision. But here's the thing. We haven't gotten back to square one yet, much less growth. We took such a chunk out, that 6%, we should have seen maybe not a big number the next year, but last year we should have seen a 4 or a 5% print, and we went actually the other way because you know what? We have entangled ourselves, in my opinion, we have entangled ourselves so much with the whole world for the benefit of trying to get them to buy our products that this entanglement has led our banks and our entire system, which, by the way, if you look at the amount of money that is on the balance sheet of the U.S. Fed from other banks around the world, it tops what now was put there back in when the Lehman situation happened because there is so much fear of other banks. They're not putting it into other banks around the world. And when you look at what's happening now, you have to wonder, are we so entangled that we've actually put ourselves into a, you know, boxed ourselves into a corner that this European mess now does affect us when maybe 25 years ago it didn't?
Well, of course it affects us. I mean, that's why the markets are down 20%. I mean, my opinion on this is that a lot of the things that you just said, I just been reading about for the past couple of years, and I believe with the market down, they're factored in. In terms of the economy, I do think that we're going to see a pickup. I think this is overblown. I mean, look, that's just my opinion. I could be 100% wrong. You could be 100% right. It's I feel based on the numbers that I see. Yeah. It's just, we're seeing auto sales. We're seeing good numbers on consumer spending. We're not seeing an indication of a huge recession if we do get one. I mean, a very mild one if we do get one. Right. But I just think we're going to see economic growth pick up because, again, I look to corporations as well. I mean, they're not hiring, but they have a lot of money to spend. And I think they're going to really start picking up that spending because they have so much money on their balance sheets. I think that there's a lot of positives in this economy. There's also a lot of negatives. We read about them every single day. It's just, you know, my opinion is the second half is going to be a lot better than what we've seen over the past couple of months. And again, and I could be wrong on that.
I will tell you this, and I will totally agree with you, that it is not only surprising, but it's nice to see how resilient, generally speaking, how resilient the consumer has been. Yet, even with their really awfully negative attitude on the consumer sentiment numbers, they're actually spending money. Now, where those consumers are from and who those consumers are, I don't know. But the fact is that somebody's buying something, and that's a good sign. And we saw the same store sales come out yesterday or 2 days ago. When was it? Oh, it was Thursday. Not yesterday. It was Thursday. When we see this kind of, I guess, attitude of, you know, we're buying anyway, and even though a lot of the employment benefits are running out, I mean, there's got to be some glimmer of hope for the future. So I do give you that. And I do agree also that companies, aside from everything, by the way, many companies are some of the best shape they've ever been on their balance sheet. So I do agree that if it is something significant, many companies will be able to weather the storm pretty well.
Yeah, let's hope so, because we do fall into another recession and we pull back, we're going to see the stock market get hit a lot further. Right now, I just don't see that.
Well, we're just, you know what? Whether you and I see it or not, the bottom line is, like any good investor, you know what? You don't fight the tape too much, maybe do a little bit, but you don't try to predict and then get squashed because it didn't go your direction, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I hear you. Frank Curzio, Stansberry Research. Go check out all the newsletters that he has and all the different information that is available from his various research, and maybe find out about those genetic companies that are providing you for your DNA sequencing, and take home your own version and your own special double helix. How great is that?
Well said.
That's their new logo. Hey, thanks so much. We'll see you next week, folks. Have a great Labor Day weekend. Take some time off. Remember, you're going to probably see some volume pickup next week because we have a lot of the traders back looking at what's going on. And, you know, you'll see that kind of ease in towards the end. I'll tell you, you know, we're looking for an increase in the volume as well, and increase a little bit in the volatility. But until next time, have a really great end of summer. If you're sending your kids off to school, hey, that's great. And if you're spending some time on the beach this weekend, that's great. And we'll see you next week. We have some great guests coming up. Larry Williams, legendary investors coming up. Barron's head editor is Mike Santoli coming up in a couple of weeks. Lots more and a great year ahead. So thanks for tuning in to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.